morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. If you've lived around here for a while, at some point or another, you've probably heard comments like, "Oh my God, that's so Midwestern," or "That's such a Midwestern thing." Well, later in the show, we'll try to figure out what that even means by checking in with our weekly Tell KCUR segment and by inviting you to call in with your own thoughts on the matter. But for now, I'd like to turn to the guy who got us thinking about all of this in the first place. Bill Tamaeus, former Kansas City Star columnist, active journalist, and author of a new memoir. Hi, Bill. Welcome to Central Standard.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Nice to meet you. I mean, I didn't even realize. I can't believe we've never met before.
I know. That doesn't seem right. I've heard your voice for lots of years.
And I've read your columns for many. Well, so most people in town think of you as just totally in association with the Kansas City Star. When did you start working for the paper?
I came to the Star in 1970. I had been, I was a Missouri J School grad in 67, and I spent my first 3 years on the Rochester, New York afternoon paper, the Times Union, which, like most afternoon papers around the country, no longer exists. But I came to the Star in September of 70 and as a reporter, and I became the Starbeams columnist in 77 after Bill Vaughn died.
Tell people what Starbeams was.
Starbeams was a humor column. It was a series of 12 one-liners plus one for the front page, based both on that day's news and on observations about life. It was kind of the print equivalent of the opening of the David Letterman show or the Jay Leno show. Political satire and sort of gentle observations about life. But as I was doing that, I also began to write narrative humor columns, and then I began to write narrative more serious stuff. And eventually, after 27 years of writing that daily column, I eventually moved my column to the Saturday faith section, religion section. And I wrote a weekly column there and did other news and analysis pieces for that area and took formal retirement in mid-06. But I kept writing the column until the end of 08. And today I still do a daily blog that's on the Star's website. And I write a monthly column for a National Presbyterian magazine, and I write a biweekly column for the National Catholic Reporter.
You're busier in retirement than a lot of people in their actual jobs.
Well, kind of, yeah. But it's my busy. It's not the Star's busy anymore.
That's very cool. Well, you aren't a lifelong Kansas Cityan, and that might surprise a lot of people. You were born in a town in Illinois, a town called Woodstock. And in fact, the title of your new memoir is Woodstock, A Story of Middle Americans.
Right. Woodstock, Illinois, is northwest of Chicago. It's about 20 minutes straight south of Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And it is named after a place that I passed through a week or so ago, Woodstock, Vermont, because the people who settled Woodstock, Illinois, originally came from Woodstock, Vermont. And after Woodstock was named Centerville because it was in the center of McHenry County, somebody said, "That's a dumb name. Let's put something better on it." So they put Woodstock on it, and there are Woodstocks all over the country, including most famously the Woodstock Rock Festival. But this is now northwest of Chicago in dairy and corn land.
Tell us what it was like to grow up there. I mean, I know that's kind of asking you to unpack your whole book, but what are some of the crucial characteristics of growing up in Woodstock, Illinois, when you did?
Well, I would say that Woodstock was a small town. In 1950, it was about 7,000 people, a little over that. Today, it's about three times that, but there was always a sense, as someone once joked, in a small town, even if you don't know what you're doing, somebody else does. and so there was always a sense of being interdependent, of being a community and communal. We babysat for each other's children. We could wander into a neighbor's house and expect to be fed. We didn't lock our doors. Everybody in town knew we had a key to our house, and everybody in town knew that it was hung on a nail just inside the little back porch. And
so why even lock the door?
Well, it's a good question. I suppose it's because sometimes we left town. And as a matter of fact, one of the characteristics of people in Woodstock is that they got out of Woodstock. they traveled. My experience with people on both coasts, and indeed the southern coast as well, is that they tend to be very parochial. They never get out to the Midwest, practically. And they think of us as flyover country here. They think that the only Kansas City is in Kansas and that sort of thing.
Or they feel very proud that they know it's in Missouri.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But people in Woodstock got out of there, and my family was certainly among them. We, in 1956, my dad moved us for 2 years to India, of all places. So there was a broader view from the center of the country, if you will.
Talk about your years in India.
My dad was part of a University of Illinois agriculture team, and he was sent to teach extension service and set up extension curricula at the Allahabad Agricultural Institute in north central India. I attended boarding school for a while in the mountains, and guess what the name of the school was?
What was it?
Woodstock School.
Weird.
I know. Woodstock School then was primarily a school for American missionary children. But today it's an international school, and I would guess today only about 20% of the students are American.
And you wrote in your book about this experience that being at boarding school was like being an unwanted alien in a foreign place. That's how you think back on this time?
Yes, I do. It turns out missionary children can be very cruel, and part of the reason for that is that they were sort of unceremoniously dumped by their parents in this boarding school and had to survive, sort of Lord of the Flies-like. And what they did was pick on other people. I later have become friends with these people, many of these people in this country. I see them as adults. They're wonderful people. And I say, why did you do that to me? And they say,
yeah, why were you such a jerk?
And they say, well, you should have seen what we did to so-and-so. And we have no idea why, except that it was just a way of surviving. So a very strange time.
Yeah. Well, do you think that your time in India caused you to view the Midwest when you returned as sort of an observer in a way? Because you have retained such full memories. It's very impressive.
Mm. I do. When I came back, I was in seventh grade, and I immediately noticed that I was no longer the tallest kid in class. Maybe it was because I drank very little milk in India. I don't know. And I don't know. I'm 6'3" and a half. I don't know how tall I'd be had I never gone overseas. But yeah, I began to notice and compare how things were in India versus how things are in Illinois, northern Illinois. And it began to make a difference in my life in the sense that I would contrast and compare, and these memories would stick.
There's a saying, someone who's never left home still thinks their mom makes the best soup. Did you have a little bit of that kind of feeling too?
I have tasted soup that's a lot better than my mother ever made. And although I loved my mother and visited her and dad's grave just a few weeks ago up in Woodstock when I went to do some book events, I have a broader sense of life than that. There are some people certainly in Woodstock who never left. But even those people, I think, tend to have a bit broader view of life than being stuck in one place.
You dedicate an entire chapter of this book to your boyhood home at 832 Dean Street, and it used to be attached to a corner grocery. Tell our listeners about that house.
The house was on a wedge corner that streets ran either side of it, and attached to the house was a little convenience store that a guy named Joe, and I can't remember his – you've complimented me in my memory, and here I'm going to say no, what her name was, maybe Ruth. But they sold candy and they sold little grocery things, and it was – we kind of lived above that store. And that's the house in which I was not born in that house, but when I was born, that's where we were living. And right across the street was a little park. Sunnyside Park, and it was, you know, it was sort of bucolic and pretty. And my memories of that house took me in the book to the question of what is home.
Exactly. And that is such an interesting meditation. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think when I think of home, there are places where I've lived in my life that feel nothing like home. I think of my first apartment in Rochester, New York, when I first took my first job out of college. And it was in a big old brick building right at the edge of downtown. And I just never felt that was mine. But there is a place that I go most every summer in northern New Mexico called Ghost Ranch, where I often teach a class. It's a National Presbyterian Conference Center. And that feels very much like home. 415 West South Street, which was my next home in Woodstock, feels like home, even though to become a whole full adult, I had to get away from there and get away from kind of the strings that my mother wanted to keep attached to me.
What kind of strings were those?
Well, my mother was a fabulous woman who was very active civically and in terms of work. She worked from the home. She was a welcome wagon hostess, and she was a society columnist for the local newspaper. And she was an English graduate from the University of Illinois right in the middle of the Depression. But she also kind of wanted to control the world, including her son. So when my sisters and I would each of us, I have three sisters, we each had to find our own way of becoming whole adults. You know, when I was in college, I would come home and go to church with mom, and she would introduce me to strangers and say, this is my son, Bill. He needs a haircut.
Well, you know, this idea of finding your own home, I wonder if the idea of something that feels like home can extend beyond the idea of like a physical structure and could extend to something as big as a landscape. So the idea of the Midwest and people feeling that the Midwest is their home, I guess as I was reading your reflections, I've been to a lot of places I love that I would consider this would be a great place to live. But there's something about the horizon line in the Midwest that when I am in the Midwest, I feel a sense of being home. And I wonder what you think about that, the idea of a landscape as home.
Yeah, I think one of the best books that kind of described that is my friend Kathleen Norris in her book Dakota, A Spiritual Geography. The sense that the land can be home to you, can provide the banks of the river through which you flow in some sense, can be a place of – can be a sacred place in some ways. So that land, the idea of land as home, I think is a really valid idea. And it's one that I experience when I go back to Woodstock these days, as I was up there a few weeks ago. And, you know, I drove by my old house.
Did you wonder where your bed was? I'm asking you that because you quote Kurt Vonnegut saying yeah. When he goes to his old hometown and drives by his old house, he wonders where his bed is.
Yeah, where is my bed, he says as he drives into Indianapolis. Yeah, I drove by my old house. I've been in that house since we sold it after mom died. And so I've seen it, but I was tempted. I called my granddaughter, 12-year-old Olivia, from Woodstock and said, Olivia, do you think I should go to my old house and ask if I can sleep in my old bedroom? And she laughed. She said, that would be funny, Grandpa.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman, sitting here with Bill Timaeus, who has just written a memoir, Woodstock, A Story of Middle Americans. And in case you didn't catch the beginning there, Woodstock is a town in Illinois. It's not a reference to the East Coast site of a 60s rock festival. So, Bill, I love your reflections on imagination. You write about sitting on the roof of one of your houses and imagining that you could hide there until you had read all the books you wanted to read. Mm. And imagining in bed at night who was in all those cars whose headlights threw shadows around your room. Who was in those cars? Who were the people of Woodstock?
The people of Woodstock were fundamentally decent human beings. They were people who worked hard. What Woodstock offered to the world was the Autolite plant, where people made batteries and spark plugs. And there were a lot of tool and die, small operations. There were farmers, clearly, out on the edge of town. There were people who had small businesses, the Ray Wolfs, who had a little jewelry store. And my own father, who was farm advisor, had an office. There Ray Benoy, who ran Benoy Motors and sold Packards to my mother. Very decent people who had an authenticity and an integrity that you could count on. These were people who wanted to give you good service and who wanted to somehow be part of your life. There were lots of churches in Woodstock. There was a substantial but not a majority by any means Catholic population. In fact, a few weeks ago I went to St. Mary Catholic Church in Woodstock and spoke there and told them that while I was growing up, there was a Protestant-Catholic divide. And such as our pastor would tell us in the 1960 election that if we voted for Kennedy, the Pope was going to run the country. It was that kind of bigotry.
And you also wrote about that there was one Jewish family in Woodstock, right, and that they drove to Chicago for services.
Yeah, there was no synagogue in McHenry County. There is now. It's not in Woodstock. I think it's over in McHenry. But the Neuscheller family, Doc Neuscheller was my father's physician, and Bonnie was then and remains today one of my sister's closest friends. I even see her frequently. But they had to somehow accommodate themselves to this small town. And Doc told me one time that I asked him, what was it like to be a Jewish doctor in a Protestant town? And he said, well, it took me about 10 years to get practice privileges at the local hospital where I was born.
Wow.
They wouldn't let him do that and eventually did. And so those changes of how we handle race and ethnicity and religion and so on, you can see that progress in Woodstock. It's nowhere near complete. There's still lots of stuff that's wrong about the way people think about others and diversity, but the change from the 1950s to today is frankly remarkable.
You seem really deeply affected by these kinds of issues as you witnessed them in your town as a child, and among them minstrel shows in the 1950s. Yep. Tell us about those memories and how you look back on them now.
Yeah, I was a member of a Boy Scout troop that was sponsored by my church, a Presbyterian church. And in 1956, 57, and 58, that Boy Scout troop put on three minstrel shows at the local high school. And that meant kids had to put on blackface and tell Rastus and Remus jokes and sing Old Black Joe and so on as though this were somehow entertainment. I remember practicing for the show on the stage, but the only reason that I never participated in the show is that my family moved to India before the first show happened. But if you look at the 1956 program, which I still have, on the back of it is a photograph of our troupe, and there I am in the photograph. And today, the idea of a minstrel show is so outrageous that even in Woodstock, you can't find anybody who would say, oh, that sounds like fun.
Yeah, there aren't people out there defending that.
No. And with good reason. And yet there are people who say, well, back then we thought it was just fun. And what did we know? And so nobody should have taken offense to it. And I say, really?
Yeah, because that's what I kind of wanted to get out here is that although you are trying to identify the Midwestern values that you hold dear, you're also fairly critical in this book. There's sort of a fine line between sentimentality and like whitewashing the past. And
yeah.
And I'm interested in your perspective on how you wrestle with that, where you come out in the balance.
Well, I am someone who tends to see not black and white but gray, and I tend to understand that I although I try to respond to the better angels of my nature, I am perfectly capable of evil. And so when our political leaders, for instance, divide us into evildoers and good doers, I say, oh, come on, life is more complicated than that. So in my new book, I really try to pay attention to what I thought we got right and what I thought we messed up. And I try to include myself in that. I mean, there were things that I didn't get right, that I fouled up. And I think self-critical look at life is the most helpful. And when we put our blinders on and are rigid fundamentalists, either theologically or politically or in any other way, even personally, like I'm all good, we're kidding ourselves. And we need to have a more realistic view of ourselves.
So that brings us to a conversation about what it means to be Midwestern. You write that when you talk about Middle America, you're not talking about geography. So what are you talking about then?
Well, I write there that in some ways being a Middle American is a state of mind. It is a way of being pragmatic, of being practical, of not being a fundamentalist either, as I say, theologically or politically. It's a way of caring about other people, of being communal, of really trying to be a positive part of your social community. There are lots of other things that go into it, including a respect for humanity, a kind of idea that all of us are of inestimable worth and we should treat each other that way.
So we aren't strictly talking about geography, but can we talk about geography for a second? Because
yep.
Which states constitute what we call the Midwest is actually a source of at least internet debate, if
yep.
not further debate.
Yep.
What do you think is the Midwest geographically?
Woodstock, Illinois.
Well, it's so funny you should say that, though, because the 538 blog recently conducted a survey asking people who identify as Midwesterners which states they thought were in the Midwest, and most of them answered whatever state they lived in and one neighboring state.
Yeah, yeah. I tend to think of the Midwest as stretching as far as Ohio, which is much of which is in the Eastern Time Zone, as far north as Detroit, Michigan. Which is Detroit is in the Eastern Time Zone. In fact, I'm heading up there in a couple of weeks to give a talk about my previous book. But and I tend to think of it as stretching as far west as Eastern Colorado, as far north as almost to Canada, if not there. And I think when you go south, once you get much further south than Little Rock, you're probably in the South versus the Midwest. And I'm not even sure I would include Little Rock in the Midwest.
In this survey, one thing that kind of cracked me up is that the three states that were most unanimously identified as Midwestern were Iowa, Illinois, and Indiana. And that does skew kind of east, actually. And I wondered if it's just a state that starts with I.
That's right.
Well, and I've noticed that you've chosen to use the phrase Middle America and not Midwest. Is there a reason for that?
Well, the reason I did that is that I think Middle American values are broader than the Midwest. As I say in the book, it was really hard not to be a Middle American in the Midwest. But you could be a Middle American in terms of values, commitments, approaches to life, while living in Sarasota, Florida, or Eugene, Oregon, or Rochester, New York, or Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It was an approach to life and not a geographical designation.
There is a passage that I'd really love for you to read before we go to our break and get back to this conversation about Midwestern identity. In this passage, you capture something kind of sinister, a sense that under a cheerful exterior, there's danger and darkness that's maybe unspoken and left to fester. And that's on page 6. Would you mind reading that paragraph?
Yeah, this is in a chapter called The Square, and that's a reference to the Central Business District of Woodstock. And it says this: despite assurances from parents and preachers, coaches and teachers that virtue in my hometown was ubiquitous, there was always a hint of darkness at the edges of our young lives, always a disquieting suspicion that the mother of boys our age had committed suicide for an understandable reason, always a hunch that people who shouldn't have been were, nonetheless, having sex, getting drunk, cheating on their taxes, and not closing their eyes when they prayed.
I love that, not closing their eyes when they prayed. That paragraph feels so familiar to me as far as what it means to be Midwestern.
Yeah, the praying thing is a reference to the way religion was done when I grew up. There were certain things you did and certain things you didn't do. Now, closing your eyes when you pray is a metaphor, obviously, for a broader sense of that. But if you went outside the boundaries, you at least got strange stares and you got questioned about it. So there was a sense of community boundaries about faith matters, and that's what I was about.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation about Midwestern values and Midwestern identity. And we'll want to hear from you. We'll also check in with our Tell KCUR segment, what you've been telling us all week long about this subject. I'm Gina Kaufman. You've been hearing from Bill Timaeus, and we will be right back. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman here with Bill Timaeus talking about his new memoir, Woodstock, A Story of Middle Americans. But Bill's book got us wondering what the people of Kansas City think it means to be a Midwesterner. Why don't you talk? It's time for our weekly Tell KCUR segment. And for that segment, I'd like to welcome community engagement reporter Laura Ziegler to the studio. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Gina.
So what was the challenge we posed to our listeners this week?
We asked people this question: what does it mean to be Midwestern in 5 words or less? And I will say it was a very popular question. We got tons of responses, a lot of which echoed what Bill Timaeus was just talking about.
That's so cool. I love that we had this challenge with the 5 words or less. What are some of the things people talked about?
Number one, we heard that we were hardworking, friendly, and polite over a number of times, many times.
We're all friendly and polite, so we never get in arguments here.
We heard some differences. There were some differences of opinion on that, but a lot of people referenced those three adjectives. We're also, according to our responses on Twitter, Facebook, and even some old-fashioned phone calls, underappreciated, family-oriented, and pragmatic. We feel we know what's really important. We have a sense of our priorities, and among them, compassionate, considerate, grounded, unpretentious, with integrity. But we did have a lot of detractors who characterized Midwesterners as intolerant, narrow-minded, clueless, isolated, poorly located, and, depending on your perspective, Jell-O lovers.
That's funny. Jell-O with something suspended in it, perhaps?
Didn't distinguish.
I want to address this hardworking thing because I know what people mean, and that is something people say so often, that we have this Midwestern work ethic. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of friends in New York. They routinely leave the office at like 8 or 9 p.m. Do we really have a...
You know, again, I think that depends on your perspective. Personally, I feel like all of these characteristics are ultimately subjective. You know, it
Absolutely.
Depends on who you are, who you know, where you live, and who you know, what your attitude is.
And so would you say that our listeners broke down into different attitudes toward life here? I feel like among people I know, there's kind of a split between people who have really intense Midwestern pride and people who would love nothing more than to get out of this place.
That's accurate. And that's what we found. We found actually three categories of people. We sort of broke them down into three categories. And they were what I'm going to call the haters, the people who really don't want to be here, the critics who said things with a little less vitriol, and the people who kind of had an earnest love for the Midwest and some of those characteristics that I mentioned earlier. Among the haters, we heard from Allison on Facebook who said, living in literal hell. Marcy said, get me out of here. And also on Facebook, Stephanie said, tired of being called Dorothy. I don't know if that's a hater, but I know a lot of people who actually talk about that. Among the critics who talked a little less strongly about not wanting to be here, Sally on Facebook said, it's a great place to live, but I wouldn't want to visit. I thought that was interesting. Andrea writes, politeness at all costs, which I think refers to kind of a narrow-mindedness. And John says being Midwest is longing for mountains and ocean. Hmm. Actually, we heard on that, we heard about that location question from a number of people, and we're going to hear from a couple of people now, one of whom refers to that relation to the coast, and another kind of about our psyche as Midwesterners.
My phrase is awaiting changes from the coasts. In other words, we're always waiting for the trends and the new things from each of the coasts here in the Midwest.
The greatest sin is nonconformity.
Laura, do you find some truth in that? The greatest sin is nonconformity here in the Midwest?
I do, sometimes. You know, I think that my personal feeling is, you know, home is where the heart is, and you find all kinds of people everywhere. But, yeah, often I think there is a kind of tendency to go along with everybody.
Well, what about these earnest folks with only good things to say about living here?
Well, here's some of what they said. On the subject of where we live, Don writes, amused intolerance of coastal provincialism. And Emily wrote, content without oceans and mountains. So there are those people. Nobody mentioned the prairie, which I think is very beautiful. Melissa tweeted these five words, friendly, hardworking, integrity, values, community. Marge wrote, humble and hardworking. Again, that hardworking theme. Priscilla wrote on Facebook, focus on farm to fork. Which I think is
so
a big
one. So some advice.
Yeah, but I also think that you're finding that all across the country. Liz wrote, finding beauty in simple things. And Micah wrote, subtle beauty underappreciated. Kara says, diversity, creativity, and great attractions. Emily says on Facebook, content without oceans and mountains. And Candace writes, being Midwestern is enjoying the low cost of living. And Joshua writes, the antithesis of elitism.
Those are funny words with which to say not elitist, but I appreciate that.
Yeah. Just a couple of more things about lifestyle. Andrew wrote lightning bugs and thunder, and Heidi wrote buttered corn on the cob. And maybe this one that I agree with most, enjoy all four seasons. That's something that I really appreciate about the Midwest.
Laura, what would be, if not your five words, your sentiment, your overriding, this is Midwestern to me?
I think for me, it's natural beauty and urban newness. Lots going on urban, and I love the natural beauty. How about you?
Well, I answered on Twitter, and my answer was, we make our own fun. And I think there are a lot of things that people have said in all of these comments that are true, but I just focused on what I love about the Midwest, which is there are some places in this country where it seems like the dance card's kind of full. You know what I mean? And we're in a place where there are things to be done and where our fun isn't just sitting there waiting for us. But if you love to be active rather than passive in your entertainment, then that's great.
There's a lot to discover.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for visiting with us, Laura. It's been great as always. Love the Tell KCUR segment.
You're welcome.
I gotta get away from the state of day.
And we're back in the studio with Bill Timaeus talking about Woodstock, a story of middle Americans, and talking to you because there's still time to join this conversation about what you think it means to be Midwestern. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. That number again is 816-235-2888. And Bill, a trait that you identify as Midwestern is an ability to adapt to change. the example you give from the town you grew, where you grew up, is letting go of typewriters and taking up with the computer. Mm-hmm. This in spite of the fact that your town's best known export was a brand of typewriter. Can you explain what's Midwestern about that?
The typewriters that Woodstock made actually were named the Woodstock typewriters, along with the Oliver typewriters that they made. And you may remember that one of the reasons the Alger Hiss case got solved was because of a Woodstock typewriter that someone had written a note on. But those were hardworking people who produced the technology of the time, and time overtook them. So they had to find other things to do and other ways of being. When I began my career in journalism, I was typing on an old manual upright Underwood typewriter. And
not a Woodstock?
Unfortunately, no. I have a Woodstock on my home shelf, no, it was an Underwood. And slowly, technology changed. And today, almost everything I write is in cyberspace. One column that I write is in print and online. But we've been able to adapt to these changes as they came along. Sometimes we did it slowly and not very well, and I criticize the Kansas City Star itself for that. We were always, it seemed, half a step behind the technology, and it was frustrating. And I don't know why that was the case, but we didn't have leaders there who understood where technology was going, and they were always reacting to it. But we were able, over the long term, we were able to react to change and to produce some of this change ourselves.
You know, what's interesting is that when I hear this idea about adapting to change being a Midwestern trait, I guess I conducted some informal research of my own, just talking to friends and family recently about what they think. And a term that came up a couple of times in those conversations was resignation, which mm-hmm. might be sort of a more negative term for accepting of change.
Yeah, you certainly find that. My colleague at the Star, Charles Guswell, never wanted to type on a computer, and you know, made kind of a show of moving his typewriter outside in front of the fountains at the Star and typing his column out there in one day instead of on the computer. And we joked that he was a Luddite. But so there is a sense of sometimes of just resigning to change, and yet. In many ways, we helped to lead this change, the generation, my generation, and others that I call middle Americans.
Can I point something out that I've noticed in terms of when what you attribute to Midwesternness in your book and what just you accept full responsibility for yourself? Yeah. It sounds to me like you consider the good things about you to be Midwestern. And every aspect of yourself that you find fault with is yours and yours alone. You won't blame the Midwest for those things. To me, this speaks of a kind of humility and self-deprecation. And I wonder if that could, in and of itself, be a Midwestern trait or at least a Midwestern ideal. Are Midwesterners kind of hard on themselves? Do we put ourselves down?
I think you can find that for sure. But I view it as a sense of sort of realistic way of looking at the world. We appreciate the communal values that we grew up with. We appreciate the sense of people in this together. And when that fails, I think we tend to look at ourselves and see, how did I contribute to that failure? And no failure is entirely individual, and no success is entirely corporate. So it's a mix of things.
Orson Welles is from your town, Woodstock, Illinois, and you write that he described it as, quote, a wax flower under a bell of glass in the Paisley and Gingham County of McHenry. That is so poetic and evocative and just the faintest, tiniest bit insulting.
Yeah, I agree. Orson Welles attended Todd's school in Woodstock. He was not from Woodstock originally, but he did go to school there. And he later kind of romanticized the place, which is what I've tried not to do in this book, not to make it this, June Cleaver sort of place. But Wells is that they now celebrate Orson Welles in various ways in Woodstock, as we do Paul Newman, who actually lived with my family for a while when he was getting his start in summer stock in Woodstock, and others who came through there. So there's a lot of folks who with some famous names attached to my hometown.
What do you hear in that phrase, a wax flower under a bell of glass in the Paisley and Gingham County of McHenry? What does that mean to you?
That means that there is a writer named Orson Welles who was struggling to say something profound, and that's what he came up with. I think it's a silly description of Woodstock. It's a silly description of anywhere, for heaven's sakes. You can't put a glass top over a place and call it Gingham and all of that. I mean, come on. These are real people living real lives, and they are not on display in a museum. And the last thing that Woodstock is a museum. Or Kansas City, which is full of middle Americans, for heaven's sakes.
One of the things you write a lot about is family and community and connectedness. And you talk a little bit about the phrase family values, and you kind of distinguish what you mean by this Midwesternness, this Midwestern sense of connectedness, and what we know as family values.
Yeah, when we hear the phrase family values today, we automatically go to those on the theological right who are promoting anti-gay attitudes, who are promoting anti-abortion stances, who very often have their children homeschooled, those sorts of things, the kind of values you find promoted on Focus on the Family with James Dobson. That's not what I'm talking about. My sense of family values is much broader than that. In my sense of family values, it means we are there for each other through thick and thin, and we try to help members of our families be the best they can be without so much judgment. The family values that we think of when we hear that phrase today is full of judgment. The kind of family values I'm talking about is much more full of mercy and compassion and a lack of harshness.
Anymore, so many of our efforts to connect and be sort of a human family happen through social media. Is social media connectedness Midwestern in character in any way, or is that the same thing as hanging out at the town square?
No, it's not, but it certainly can have value, and it can be a part of the picture of connectedness. But ultimately, nothing replaces looking each other in the eye and seeing who that person is and having direct connection in that way. There are so many times that we have misunderstood each other and have been misunderstood ourselves through social networking, including email, that doesn't happen as often when we sit down one-on-one with each other. And so although I have, I don't know, 1,500 Facebook friends and 450 or 500 Twitter followers.
Very
and so
popular.
On. And of those 1,500 Facebook friends, I probably know 200. But the point is that we use those tools, but they can't really replace personal contact.
Well, hold that thought, because you are listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Bill Timaeus, former columnist for the Kansas City Star and who continues to be an active journalist. He's just written a memoir, Woodstock, a story of middle Americans. And there's still time for you to weigh in on this conversation about what it means to be middle American at 816-235-2888. Willie from Baldwin just called that number to share a quote he heard. He wanted us to read that. It's, "Any idiot can appreciate California, but it takes character, subtlety, and attention to appreciate Kansas." And that quote is from Wes Jackson of the Land Institute. Do you relate to that, Bill?
I do. And I know Wes. Wes of the Land Institute is a genius guy. And he's one of the great treasures of the Midwest.
And we also got an email. I actually think this is very funny. Someone emailed in, "Midwesterners are curious from a safe distance, and this emailer wouldn't give a name, which is sort of evidence of the point.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That's funny.
How do religion and race factor into this concept of Midwesternness?
In my experience, our own experiences with religion and race have changed pretty dramatically from the time I was born until today. The United States' religious makeup has changed, certainly after President Johnson signed immigration reform into law in 1965. Lots of people from Asia and the Southern Hemispheres have come and brought their own versions of Hinduism and Islam and Sikhism and Zoroastrianism and so on to our Midwestern neighborhoods. And we've had to figure out how to be in harmony with them, how to live harmoniously with them. And the same with race. When I was growing up, we had one black family in Woodstock. And today it's a much more diverse place. And it's not to say that bigotry doesn't exist there now. It certainly does. But there is a sense that we are broader and bigger than just WASPs, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. That's no longer who America is, and we've had to adapt to that. And I think we've done reasonably well with that.
We haven't talked a lot about agriculture, and you didn't grow up on a farm, but your parents did. And you write a little bit about having the farm in your DNA. What is farm DNA?
Well, it is recognizing that food doesn't come from Price Chopper. It comes from some source before that. It has to do with hard work on the land. A few weeks ago, I visited the farm that my dad grew up on in Delavan, Illinois. His brother, who's 92 now, still farms it, could arm wrestle me down in about 10 seconds. And it's that commitment to being a presence there and knowing that things are more complicated than just buying food off of a vendor truck.
Let's hear from Alberta in Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Alberta.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I called to contribute one of my favorite ideas, which is inverse provinciality, which shows that people in the Midwest really know much more about what's going on in the world than people who are in major cities.
Explain what you mean.
You know what I mean? Because if you live inside the Beltway, you are so consumed with what's going on inside the United States government that you are ignorant of what goes on farther away. For example, to put it in a worldwide scope, most of us couldn't say the name of the capital of Ghana. But all over the world, in every country, people know that Washington is the capital of the United States. So we're more ignorant, we who are in the seat of power, than the rest of the world.
Let me respond quickly to that. Here's a good example of why you're right. I know Accra is the capital of Ghana, and one reason I know that is that my own daughter spent 6 months in Accra after she graduated from Mizzou. And those are the outreach efforts that Midwesterners and Middle Americans often make that, as you say, people on the coast sometimes don't or within the Beltway.
And the idea, she was mentioning the seat of power, and I think the sort of comparison there is that with nationally, the seat of power feels like it's on the coast, so therefore we in the middle have to be aware of the coasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true.
You consider creativity a Midwestern trait, and I totally agree, though I don't think that's a popular perception. How do you define creativity? What is Middle American creativity?
I think Middle American creativity has to do with recognizing possibilities, with seeing that you can take very everyday things, mundane things, quotidian things, and do fresh things with them. It's just a way of contrasting and comparing, juxtaposing two ideas and coming up with a third idea that's fresh.
We've got time to quickly hear from Greg in Kansas City, Missouri. Greg, go fast. We're running out of time here.
Okay, I'll go real fast. if you read Whatever Happened to Kansas, that's a good example of a description of the rural-urban dichotomy that's occurred in the increasingly reactionary environment, both politically and from a religious standpoint, that exists in rural Missouri and Kansas, which happened, you know, when you look at what happens in the Missouri and Kansas legislatures, you see, you know, a real strong and growing reactionary element.
Well, and I think this idea that maybe we are a divided Midwest and that the division is urban-rural, is that something that you perceive?
There is an urban-rural split for sure, but I think it's more complicated than that. I think you can find people who would be, say, Tea Party people in the cities, and you can find quite progressive folks out in the rural areas. So you can't just black and white it.
Before we go, Bill, there's a phrase that you used that I found intriguing: bloated optimism. At the risk of asking a Captain Obvious type question, what is bloated optimism and what does it have to do with Midwestern values?
Oh, my. Bloated optimism to me is a kind of false way of looking at things. It is a sense that everything is going to come out all right and there's nothing wrong with the world. God's in heaven and all's going to be well. And I think that's not very realistic. And I think a lot of people with middle American values that I try to describe in my book don't think that's very healthy.
But wait, everything might not be okay?
That's right.
You're shocking me and taking the ground out from under me.
Get used to it, Gina. Get used to it.
Well, that is all the time we have for today's conversation. And we didn't even get to sports, so maybe we'll save that for another day. Thanks so much to everyone who called, tweeted, Facebook messaged, or otherwise participated in this redefinition of what it means to be Midwestern. And thanks to you, Bill Timaeus, for taking time with me today. It's been fun getting to know you.
Thank you. I appreciate being here.
You can listen back to today's conversation or any past discussions on Central Standard at kcur.org/Central Standard. Go ahead and sign up for our podcast while you're there. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross, along with interns Matt Hodapp and Christina Leffring. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and we've had extra help from reporter Suzanne Hogan. Tune in tomorrow for the food critics talking about pizza. I'm Gina Kaufman, and friends, that's it for today. Stick around for Up to Date. That's coming right up after this break.